Yeah, thank you very much. You see my email address and my Jabber account on the first slide. So if you're watching this on a video recording, or if you cannot get hold of the microphone in the end, please make comments. Please do contact me. And here is some way to get in touch with me. So I want to speak about how to know what a text is about in an unknown language, which means in an unknown language to you or to me, not in a generally unknown language. This is a different topic, which I can address perhaps next year in 2 years or at ICMP in summer, which is another camp, a smaller camp. But here it's about languages that somebody knows something about. How to identify the language of a written text? First of all, I will show traditional ways to do so, and then, of course, how to do it with the help of computer technology. And the second part is about the question how to get at least some information out of an unknown text in an unknown language, in a language unknown to you. So the first question that comes up is, what does it have to do with hacking? Well, I take a general definition of hacking, which I've taken from Eric Raymond's dictionary. It's the intellectual challenge of creatively overcoming and circumventing limitations. And we have a big limitations. We don't know 6,000 languages. And sometimes we want to know what is there in the text in a language we don't know. And first of all, people say, well, that's impossible. We need a translator. We need a specialist. But I hope to show you that it is possible to get at least some insight in the first place in order to decide whether a translator is really needed or whether the text is totally uninteresting. So I think it is important to make such a decision before you get in contact with your translation department. Why don't I speak about spoken texts? It is possible to do the same thing with spoken texts. There are approaches which work on a multi-language corpus of telephone calls. People have found ways to identify spoken texts too, but the strategies are somewhat different, and I won't address them in my talk here. So I will stick to written languages, and the first thing, of course, is the writing system. You get a text in a writing system, and if you are unfortunate, you get a text in Roman script. That's bad, because thousands of languages use Roman scripts, and those who usually don't use Roman scripts have a Roman transliteration system as well, so the text can be literally from thousands of languages. It gets better when you have a text in Cyrillic script, because there are more than 60 languages, which is a lot, but it's less than thousands. With Arabic, it's even better. With Devanagari script, I will show to you what that is later. It's only more than 10 languages that use that script. With Hebrew script, it's even less. And if it is another script, let's say Armenian script or Georgian script, well, there's just one language. So if you see the script, the writing system, you know what language it is. And lots of systems of identifying languages use that fact. So they try to find out what writing system that is, and then they know what language it is. They can be wrong, of course. I tested some programs that I will mention later, and I just typed some random Korean signs, and the program told me that the language was Korean. It wasn't Korean, because I just typed random signs. Yeah, so that is often used, and it's an easy way to get to identify languages. So I mentioned Devanagari. Here you have an idea what that looks like. It's a syllabic script used for languages of India and Nepal, and you can easily identify at least the script and perhaps languages with the help of some books. There is, for example, a book by Carl Faulman from the 19th century, and there are such lists, and you can see, well, you can browse through the book and find your script, and then you know, well, that must be Devanagari, and then underneath there's a table with the languages that use Devanagari, and you get to it. The drawback of that book is that it doesn't have sample texts, which would be helpful to really identify the language. But it has a great advantage because Faulman was a typographer, and he was interested in variants of scripts, so you get different fonts for each script in the book, and that makes life easy. So here's another font. Or you use the internet. There is a page called Omniglot, which contains tables of scripts and sample text, and it explains to you how a script works. So here you see how Devanagari works. There is one sign stands for a certain syllable. For example, the first one is pa, and then you can modify the vowel by modifying the sign. You add modifiers for long R, that's the signs in red, or for E, for long E, and so, for I, for long I, and so on. Yeah, or you use another book, which is in my bibliography. That's a book by Daniels and another author, which contains tables of very many different scripts, writing systems, with sample texts. So here's an example text of Armenian, and that helps a lot, because then you can really identify a language, because well, when you just have a table of Devanagari signs, you don't know whether this is a Hindi or Nepali or so, but with the help of the sample text, it gets more easy. So this book is really helpful. I used that when I studied linguistics, which was before we had the internet, so it worked. Yeah, there was a time before internet. Now, there are some problems, some classical problems. For example, if you want to identify a language in Hebrew script, so that there aren't that many, these are the usual languages you find in Hebrew, and if you don't know the Hebrew writing system, it's difficult to know what language that, which language the text is written in. But of course, you can, well, there are hints what language it is. For example, here you have a text in Biblical Hebrew, and you can recognize that rather easily, even without knowing the writing system, because you don't have any Western punctuation signs in it. They have strange punctuation signs like this one or that one, and yeah, that shows you that this is probably not modern Hebrew and not Yiddish or Ladino or something like that. And here you have the same text in Yiddish, the beginning of the Bible, and you see you have Arabic numbers, you have Western punctuation signs. Of course, you find the same thing in Hebrew too, but even if you don't learn the signs, if you compare Hebrew and Yiddish texts for, let's say, 5 minutes, you get used to the aspect. So Yiddish texts normally look more well, the words change quite a lot. There are long words and short words, and some short words always come back. For example, the articles here, di or dem. So that makes it quite easy to identify Yiddish. And of course, there are special diacritics, so vowel signs in Yiddish, but they are not always written. If you take a text from the Yiddish Wikipedia, you don't see these vowel signs, so that makes it difficult. But it's not so bad. Now, let's say you have a text in Roman script, in Roman writing systems, so that gets you into trouble because there are so many languages. And it used to be a problem, especially for librarians who had to identify what language a book is written in, and they used tables like this table, which was published by Engel in 1980, and they looked up combinations of letters, and then there's a list of languages where these combinations turn up. In some cases, it's rather easy. For example, take this combination, so there's only one language. Number two, it's Esperanto, so that's easy. But for very many combinations, there are a great number of languages, and you have to check several combinations. I tried that, and at least for the 60 languages in that list, mainly European languages, it is quite easy to identify the language. So here you see it, little an excerpt from that text. Yeah, now we come to computer-aided identification. Of course, you can do the same thing with a computer. You can count frequencies of unique characters and of character strings. This is a method that is widely used in cryptanalysis, and it can be used to identify languages. Another approach is common words recognition, which is a method based on word frequency lists, which are generated from sample texts, and the text can be analyzed word by word and compared to the list of, let's say, the top 100 words in the frequency list. Can take time and so on. There's another approach which is even which is used more often and is used in almost all the web applications that I found on the internet. That is n-gram analysis. So this analysis cuts the text into sequences of one or two or three items. So let's say our text is text. So in n-gram analysis, this is transformed. This is transformed into such sequences. So this is a blank sign TE. Then you have text, then ext and xt and the blank sign. So this is these are triples, and you can n-gram means that you can analyze 3, 4, 5. Such sequences, like grams, so to speak. So anyway, it's always the same method. You have a sample corpus, language corpus, you generate your models, and then you have the language models, and you compare your documents to these language models. You have the input document, you generate a model from the input document, then you compare the two, you can classify them, and then you can identify the language. There's one rather, this procedure, of course, has certain drawbacks. It is difficult to identify documents, multilingual documents. It was pointed out to me yesterday that there are approaches that can handle that. And the other drawback is that, if you only have 30 sample languages, you can only identify 30 languages. And if you have 400, well, your recognition gets better. But it's normally programs on the market don't have more than 400 languages in the sample base, and that's few. There is one nifty approach of language identification which has been discussed lately. It's a variant of the unique character string approach, which is based on compression efficiency. So you use a program like gzip, you have a reference model, and you add a text in the language to be identified, then you apply your gzip, and you measure the compression efficiency. If it is the same language, the compression efficiency will be high. If it is not the same language, your compression efficiency will be lower. So that's a good way to identify languages. And it has some very interesting applications. First of all, you can measure linguistic difference. That is, you can use this approach to create language families, to get to language families, to classify languages. And another interesting approach is that you can determine types of text. So, well, if you have, let's say, a corpus of email messages as a reference model, and you add text from, a newspaper article, this approach will show you that there's some difference between the texts. If you add, a newspaper article to a newspaper article, the difference won't be that high. And last night I discussed whether this can be used for, whether linguistic tools can be used for spam detection, and perhaps this could be a good way to detect spam. Well, I don't know, just an idea. But, well, if I hadn't fought against software patents, I would like to get a patent on that idea, because it could work, could make some money out of it. Yeah, now let's see what there is on the internet. There are several programs, I've listed them here, that can be used to identify text. Most of them are web applications. There's one program which work best because it has a basis of about more than 400 languages, which is Polyglot 3000. Unfortunately, this is a closed source Windows freeware, and I don't even know what method they use. I suppose it's ngram analysis, because I played a bit with it and can see that can correct certain errors and so on. And looks like ngram analysis, but I don't really know. But this was really the best. I tried some other languages. Normally, the corpus of reference models is too small, and in some cases, they don't tell you which languages are in the corpus. And yeah, I tried with some languages from the Pacific Ocean, and they always told me that it was Frisian. Well, that's not good. But actually, with Polyglot, it worked quite well. Yeah. So you can look them up, and you can try for yourself. Can be funny to test these programs. Yeah. We now come to my second part, to content analysis in quotation marks, because it's not really content analysis. It's just a dirty trick to get an approximate idea what a text is about. That's why I call it the hacker's approach. If you have a text in an unknown language, and we will do that together with a text that I collected from the internet almost randomly. The first thing you can look for are numbers, dates, and words from other languages in your text, and that can help you to identify what the text is about. And you can follow typographic hints. There may be bold and italic print in your text. There can be colored text chunks or underlined text chunks or capital letters. Words with capital letters, well, it can be names. That helps somehow. Yeah, and the other thing is well, it's a little more, it has to do with statistics and linguistics. If you can identify words in your text, that is quite helpful, because there is a very interesting phenomenon which is called Zipf's law. And Zipf's law is the following. Well, it says that very frequent words are shorter and contain less lexical information, whereas infrequent words are longer and contain more lexical information. And at the same time, that's in addition to Zipf's law from linguistics, less lexical information implies more grammatical information and vice versa. So what does that mean for our task of getting to know what a language is about? Most interesting for us are words with more specific lexical information, because they get us farther, and so we can ignore all short words, even if these short words are reiterated throughout the text. And that's a good thing for us, and that's how we can get at least some information about a text. I will demonstrate that with a text in Roman script. Of course, there are writing systems that don't distinguish words. There are writing systems like Devanagari, where sometimes words are written together. That makes it difficult. And there are writing systems like Chinese, or, well, Japanese is a mixed system, where you have where you have signs for ideas, so ideograms, and there this approach doesn't work that good, although there is something similar. Really meaningful signs that contain lots of lexical information are often more complicated than grammatical signs. So, well, at least for Japanese, that works. Yeah, but let's stick to Roman script. So here is an example. The first task for you is to identify the language. Of course, people who have followed discussions on Wikipedia about signs to use have followed perhaps the discussion on this sign and will say, oh, it's Hawaiian. It's not Hawaiian, although this sign is Hawaiian. And a system for language identification which is based on characters and character encoding will say perhaps that this is Hawaiian because of that sign, but it's not Hawaiian. So, you get an idea very easily about this language if you follow my hint to look for typographic hints. So, words written with capital letters. There are some words, and it's Samoan, this language. What is interesting, most texts in Samoan I found that I found on the internet contained the word Samoa. It's really strange. And another interesting observation, I use Google a lot to find out what this text can mean. And just for test reasons, I typed in the word Tili. And of course, I didn't get any hint to Samoan. I got lots of television programs from France. When I did it again last night, just to do it again, surprised me that was on my first Google page was Tili in Samoan. And of course, I use a personalized Google account, and they have observed me, and they have seen that he's looking for Samoan, and now they give me Samoan. It's quite scary. So use anonymizers when you use Google. Now, suppose you have never looked for Samoan words. Try very long words, especially if these words show up more than once in this text. And well, long words means that they have to contain at least three syllables, possibly more. Yeah, we've done that. Here are frequent long words. Gagana and, oh, what's that? Fa'a peretania. And yeah, it's quite easy. Well, it's difficult to get a dictionary of Samoan. If you look for dictionaries of Samoan in university libraries, you will find a Samoan grammar from Norway, and it contains a glossary. So you, well, that could be helpful, but it takes 6 weeks till the book reaches your university library, if you're not in Berlin or so. Yeah, so you can use the internet, of course, and look for Gagana and Fara Peritania, and you find, well, Gagana, I think, was my 8th Google hit. The 8th Google hit contained a translation, and Fara Peritania was the 11th Google hit. Well, the 11th Google hit contained a translation. So Fara Peritania means English, and Gagana means language. So it seems that this text is about the English language. And you have here Gagana, Fara Peritania, I Samoa, and I would say that this means the English language in Samoa. I thought Latu would be quite helpful, but this word is too short. It's grammar. After some time, I found out that it is the third person plural pronoun of Samoan. Actually, I found that out thanks to the French Wikipedia that contained that word. Strange. Later on, I tried other words, and Tagata worked. Tagata means people or person. So Tagata Samoa, people from Samoa. And Tagata Olivasa Pacifica seems to mean people from the Pacific Ocean or something like that. So obviously this text is about English in Samoa, in the world, in the Pacific region. And yeah, perhaps that is not so very interesting. It's not about terrorists, so we don't need to get a translation if you're looking for terrorists. If you're interested in linguistics, of course, we may want to get a translation. It's quite easy to get a translation because after some time you find out that this is this text comes from Wikipedia, of course. And yeah, it's a text about Samoan, and if you compare it to earlier versions of the English Wikipedia, you can guess that it is a translation from English, and yeah, then you know what it is about. Yeah, that's more or less what I wanted to show you. Now, there's time enough to get for your questions and for some discussion, so please, yeah. Say something.
Hello, hello, yeah. Martin.
Yeah, if you get the microphone, then
yeah. Okay.
Try to get hold of the microphone, and I try to listen to you and
excellent.
Find an answer.
Excellent. I have a quick question. How would you try and use some of those techniques on a system like, for instance, the quipu system from that the Incas used, which is a system of knotted cords? For instance, are there some techniques that you can use to try and decipher that?
Yeah. Well. Well, it depends what you want to do. If you you can try to. But the idea is that you work on already deciphered languages,
and
I don't think that the Inca code of knots is deciphered, but I'm not a specialist on that. There's one interesting thing, and I thought I could have shown that to you, which concerns Inca. Inca use portraits, small portraits of people as signs for numbers.
Yeah, pictograms.
Pictograms. And that is quite interesting. And, with numbers, it's a smaller set, and they combine in a certain way, and you can figure out how it works rather easily. Yeah. So, but you know, that is numbers and not
The quick
words,
thought, the quick thought that I had was that Quechua, the spoken language, has been transcribed into the Roman character set. And by doing frequency analysis between the Quipus and the Quechua, a known Quechua text or oral legend, and you assume that the word frequency is about the same, you might be able to do some sort of comparative analysis.
Oh, yeah, that sounds interesting. Yeah.
So there's a PhD for you.
is well known, so that is not a problem. Yeah, it's a good idea. I would do that. Yeah.
Right, okay. I'll let you know how it works out.
So my question refers to your part about
other questions.
Yeah. Is it working? Yeah. So. About this compression method thing.
I can't hear you.
Is it working? Yeah. No?
Yeah.
Well, about this compression method thing.
Yeah.
If I got it right, you can use it for comparing text types as well as identify the language.
It works for
which,
both.
Which means that that the text type influences the output. If so. This also implies that we need to know the kind of text type in order to identify the language, which seems to be kind of a circle, because usually we would expect to know the language in order to identify the text type. I mean, of course, if we receive an email, we know text type email, but if we have a book, we don't know if it's about computers, about a novel or whatever. So how to solve this kind of vicious circle thing?
Yeah. Yeah, that is a problem. Actually, the text type thing turned up when I experimented with the approach myself, and the problem is that, for example, in French emails, French emails are so different from written French texts because, first of all, there's that problem of character encoding with accented letters and so on. That this is really, the difference was very big. But I would say that in general, if you don't know anything about the language and want to identify it with this method, you get very close. Because at least the French emails I worked with came within the range of Romance languages. So the mix-up was between Spanish and French and so on. So, you know, there's always a language family thing. So you get quite close. For language identification, the difference between the different texts are sort of a nuisance, you know, but which is not too harmful. So you still get a good idea. What language the text is in. And then I got to the idea that one can use the same method for the identification of text source. That's not in the literature. So in the literature, you only read that if the text comes from a very different source, there may be difficulties. And then I thought, it's a good idea to use it for text source. That is... The reason why I think that the idea is original enough to get a software patent on it.
you showed in your lecture that there are already some programs or code to distinguish the language that is a text in, but is there already an implementation for the second part of your lecture?
No.
For determining that, or do you plan something like that, or does somebody plan something like that?
As far as I know, there's no implementation for the second part. At least, well, there can be some implementation, but I don't know that. I guess that Google has something like that, because they must know what language somebody is interested in. So why could they know that I was interested in Samoan at some point? Well, there must be something like that. But I don't really know that there is... I don't really know a computer implementation of the second part. The second part is, let's say, what linguists do when they... look at texts. They look at numbers, typographically interesting words, and so on, and then they try to make a guess. We did that in Cologne when I studied linguistics there. We had a course on Guarani, and there was no material on Guarani, and we had to find out something about Guarani, and we had a Guarani speaker who came once a week, so we prepared our transcriptions, and then we tried to find out things with him, and yeah, of course, that was exactly that way that I showed to you, but I don't know of any implementation.
There is a hint if you are looking at HTML. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah?
Did I interrupt you?
No, I just thought of the second part. Perhaps I will do a project on that, and perhaps I will try to find to work on an implementation. But I don't know yet. So,
if you're looking at HTML text, it's a good hint to look at the source code. Just in the beginning, in good HTML, there is a language code, and sometimes it's true.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Also, it's a good hint to learn foreign scripts. Mm-hmm. I read Cyrillic script pretty well, and I could very well identify words that help to identify language in all Cyrillic script languages, which I found, which is pretty many.
Mm-hmm.
I always stumble about dates, apparent dates, which I can't read because they are in some index scripts, mm-hmm. and I'm going to learn that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
About this compression thing, since since compression reduces redundancy or removes redundancy from data, does that say anything about the redundancy in languages? Because since language has a lot of redundancy, so we can understand each other.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, of course. There is lots of redundancies, and one can reduce that. Actually, redundancy is sort of a problem with this approach. I prepared another text of this kind that came from Basque, and then I thought it was not a good idea to show that, because due to redundancies, some verb forms are so long that you think that they are content words. And, well, you realize that when you put it into your favorite search engine. But, you know, it shows that life is not so easy. You know, that, yeah.
Okay.
But, of course, redundancies are in every language, and they are useful for communication. They are not so useful if you really want to strip everything off and only have the direct access to information, of course.
Yeah, but what I meant was, is the compression rate let's say in German maybe it's 43% and in Italian it's 75%. Can you say that Italian has more redundancies in it than German or something?
You can't
like that.
Say that. No. That's not measurable.
Okay, that was my question.
Okay. Hi, Martin. I'm over here.
Hi.
The languages you've been talking about are ones that you already have that you can sort of read in front of you. What if you had a digital text that you a digital file that you assume is a text, but you don't know the coding for it? Yeah. You don't know whether it's in any of the Unicode whatever things. Do you just try through all the different ones? Because you can get interesting things in Chinese and Devanagari and whatever. Do you know of any way of going about with that?
Yeah, I would try the compression approach for that, because with the compression approach, you don't really have to know how to read the text. You know, if in your database there is a text which has to be in the same compression in the same encoding, of course, then you can match them. Because if there is no model in your database, you won't get a result. But that I would try that, because for that approach it's not even necessary that you read the text. That's why it's interesting for spam detection too, because you don't have to read the email messages. You just take them as randomly encoded texts and can compare them.
Just something that came to my mind to your confession method. I think the German police, or BKA, this could also be helpful to them, because after they searched for terrorists on Google, they could verify them using your compression method.
Yeah, of course they can, yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, yeah. Well, I personally think that, let's say, from our perspectives, the world is full of intelligence agencies and police departments that are using nifty methods to find terrorists. But I think people who really need such approaches, like, well, for example, the second part of my talk, other people, that want to, well, firms like Google that have to treat very many texts from very many different languages and have to know at least some, have to get at least some idea what these texts are about. So for them, this approach is interesting, and I would say that police and intelligence agencies can use these methods too, and will use these methods too, but they aren't those who profit in the first place. I think they can rely on their traditional methods as well, and they will perhaps rely on these methods too. More questions?
Okay, sorry, I don't want to add any more questions. There are many things I think of. What you now started with is the thing I'm very impressed of. I want to thank you for bringing this issue into the Chaos Hackers Conference. And putting up linguistic hacking, it's a world of, you will never finish in doing that. As just the young guy there, he said, BKA is using it. Maybe we could use your approach. I think it's, you know, everybody knows, it's very important to know the tools of the enemy. And I see this in something like data mining.
Yeah.
Methods.
That is
they are the most popular and important now tools and technologies for identifying and spies. Mm-hmm. And I see that also as a counter spy approach, but I don't want to leave it in this corner. I love languages. Mm. I only want to finish with, probably because you said you're a, because you're a Wikipedian, you forgot to say that Wikipedia itself, it's one of the biggest, best tools for fans of language, and you can play with Wikipedia and different languages, different symbols and signs without end. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you for that remark. Actually, Wikipedia gives you a corpus for more than 200 languages, and perhaps not because some Wikipedias are so small, but at least for more than 100 languages, which is quite a lot, and that can be helpful. But just to come back to the police thing, to the BKA, I think for them it's not so efficient to use just these approaches because, well, I don't know much about what terrorists do, but I believe the terrorists don't write openly that they put a bomb there and there at that hour. So, you know, I would say that in such fields they use at least some sort of steganography or something like that to hide what they want to say. So even in a completely innocent text about the English language in Samoa, there might be a hidden meaning. So perhaps it's not enough to use such techniques if you want to do a police or intelligence investigation.
The thing with the BKA is, I think, not to know what the language is about, but if you find a letter, for example, then you can trace it back to the original.
Yeah. And for that approach, this compression thing approach is interesting if you can determine similarities between texts, and then you can use it to identify perhaps an author or so.
Okay, I've got one remark. As you shown this Samoa example, I think there is Samoa word because most Samoan texts are written in by linguistics or another scientist interested in language. For example, if you take Polish text, you wouldn't find many Polish texts which contain Polska, Polski, and other. Such words. So let's assume that Samoan language gets momentum and everyone in this room learns Samoan. So as number of people talking with this language grows, it will be less text about text, but more text about real life and so on. So in such case, it would be necessary to switch to another method of recognizing this language.
Yeah, of course, but still, you know, even in a Polish text, you may have capitalized words which are names or so, which can help you to get it identified.
Yes.
Because the name, but you may be able to find a name in Wikipedia, for example, and that can show you, oh, well, that's a guy from Poland, so this text can be Polish. But the Samoan thing, well, I don't know whether it's always linguists that write about Samoan and mention Samoa. My impression is that people from Samoa, especially when they write, they are very much interested in, well, there are newspapers, for example, where you find, on the World Wide Web, you find Samoan newspapers. And it's obvious that they are interested in things going on in Samoa. That's why they mention Samoa so often. And I think even in Polish newspapers on the internet, they will mention Poland, because Polish newspapers are primarily interested in things going on in Poland. More questions? Oh, ah, yeah. I think we have time for at least one question.
I think Google is a nice tool to solve problems, and you use the language to do this. And when I have a problem, I go to Google and solve it there, often faster than do it by myself. And now I need some tips how I can solve problems faster by using other languages. So do you have some tips to use information from China, something like this, to solve my problems in Google?
I didn't get your point.
sorry, my English isn't so good. When you're looking for a problem, you have a problem, you want to solve it in Google. You find several places where you can find the solution for your problem. And it's only in German or English. Mm-hmm. And now there is a land like China, which much people, and you need this language to solve your problems faster than by doing it on your own. And tips to do this fast.
If I can interpret your question, for example, you're looking for the solution of a problem, and you find a large amount of texts in Chinese, and you want to check whether these texts are useful in order to solve your problem.
All right.
Then you can use my method. Well, you can make use of Zipf's law with the complexity of the signs and so on to find important words and look them up in your dictionary and see whether this text is useful to solve your problem or not. And if you get the impression that the text might be useful, then, of course, you need a translator, because you won't get enough detailed information by my method, especially from Chinese, with that dirty translation approach. So you really have to get a specialist then. So that's sort of a drawback. You cannot really, with my method, you cannot really get the solution, or you won't, probably you won't get the solution from the Chinese text.
I was wondering about the practical applications of language identification, because just from what's going through my head, I think there's very few circumstances where you would just have a text that you don't have any context about where it's coming from, but you know the encoding, the character encoding and things like that. Mm. Usually I would, if it's from a Polish newspaper, I would, you know, at least sort of know geographically where that text is coming from. Mm. Or is it just basically a... what you presented here, a simple example of general text classifications, because there's not really much of a difference in identifying the language and kind of identifying the type of text it is.
Yeah, well, it depends on what you want to do. I have that problem very often, that I get a text and I have no idea what language it is in. And, for example, people who... are interested in the blogosphere, for example, get texts written in a strange language, and well, they want to know whether this is interesting, whether they should link to this text or not. And I think for analyses of the blogosphere, the problem turns up quite often, that you don't know what a language is, what language a text is in, and want to get an idea, and want to get an idea of the contents too. Of course, well, it always depends on what you're doing, and in some, well, of course, with other problems, you usually, well, you can get HTML information, as somebody has said before, on the language and so on, and it's much easier to know where the text comes from and what language it is in. Yeah, I think time's up. 2 minutes? Yeah, one question, actually.